In a world where one man does something truly amazing, okay, maybe not just one man, maybe two men, maybe three, maybe a woman, maybe a man and a woman. Well, okay, some small group of really nerdy people does something so amazing that an even smaller group of, well, nerdy glasses-wearing dudes over in Northern Europe says, wow, that's really cool. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, it's the 2012 Nobel Prizes. And we'll be discussing these next up on Inside the Black Box. Even though we won't do it like a movie trailer, we're doing that now just to get you enticed and excited about something that a lot of people think is really boring. It's the 2012 edition of the Nobel Prizes. We'll talk about chemistry, physics, and medicine or physiology. Okay, sure, there's economics, but there's only so much time in the show. And, you know, literature and what's the other one? Peace. They got their own shows. That's next up, Noble Pursuits, the 2012 edition. Next up on Inside the Black Box. Science only funnier.
Broadcasting from the heart of Georgia Tech campus, this is WREK Atlanta.
The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology.
I live on a street near the university. Are you getting this, kid? Don't know if I did.
Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science, only funnier. I'm Pete Ludovitz, and today is the 2012 edition of Nobel Pursuits. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, it's our Nobel Prize edition. Today we're going to talk a bit about the Nobel Prize in Physics, Chemistry, and Medicine or Physiology. It's not either or, it's basically one thing. It has to do with the name change they executed a while back. And admittedly, we're not going to do peace, we're not going to do literature, we're not going to do economics.
They give out peace at a different time, though, right?
Do they? Is it not?
Yeah, I think they give out peace. I mean, they give it out in an entirely different city. It's separate.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I figure peace and literature, they got their own thing. They've already given out the literature one.
Yeah, right?
It was a Chinese gentleman who writes some pretty provocative, racy stuff. It actually sounds interesting. It's actually prompted me to think about reading the translations of his books. And then economics. Have they given out economics? I don't even know. I think they did recently. And economics, I mean, should economics count as science and technology?
I don't know. Yes.
Probably.
Actually, yeah, absolutely.
Wait.
No, it should.
You change your mind there for a second?
I did.
You had some sponsorship deal in the works for discrete mathematics?
No. Well, I mean, economics is a lot of, it's a social science. It involves a lot of mathematics.
Yeah, I think it takes a little,
like we talked about before, the experiments are a little harder to control because, you know, you're not looking at atoms. You got to deal with people and the perceptions and all that stuff.
Right. But I consider it a real science, but we've only got so much time today. And in fact, we probably should revisit that. We've had economics folks on here before doing that. But before we get into, and we're going to start with physics, before we get into the Nobel Prize, let's begin the show, as we often do, with
science in the news.
And today's Science in the News has to do with something, it's not a particular article, it's just something I noticed a couple weeks ago when I was getting ready to do a demonstration. It was a demonstration that has a little twist to it that was suggested by my colleague Julie Champion in the School of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering. And in fact, this is a demonstration she does. I'm probably doing a version of it next week for some local school districts and sometime in November on a Davenport, Iowa TV station because I'm going to be out there giving a talk for the American Chemical Society. And they said, hey, you want to come on TV? And I'm like, sure. And they're like, well, can you do an interesting demo? That's always the key. We might be making liquid nitrogen ice cream. For the record, I think that's a mistake. I think we may have problems in the studio. But the other one that
we're making liquid nitrogen ice cream in the studio?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They're going to film it and let's hope, you know, nothing goes
wrong.
Yeah,
this sounds like a disaster.
Well, there's a lot of stuff to get together. And thankfully, the folks at St. Ambrose College out in Davenport are going to get those resources together for me. I didn't want to impose that on them, but we were going to make alginate worms, right? Alginate worms are real easy.
Ice cream is a better choice.
What are you saying? Alginate worms are not interesting?
No one cares about that.
Okay, so maybe we'll just do the ice cream one anyway. But in any case, for those of you who haven't seen it, it's actually a really good demonstration. Warren Matthews, who we work with here on doing some outreach on direct to discovery, actually told the teacher in the school district about it. She's all excited. She bought the kit online. You basically buy this this alginate. It's a polymer. That's a polysaccharide backbone, so it's a sugar backbone, and it's got acids hanging off the end. Normally, the ion associated with that acid, when you buy it as a powder, is sodium. If you replace that by squirting a solution of this into a calcium, solution, calcium is plus 2, right? So it can actually sort of ionically bond with 2 of these polymer chains instead of 1 like the sodium. It cross-links them together, and boom, you form this thing that comes out of solution. If you squirt it in there fast, you can actually form a worm. It's actually a really cool demonstration. But here's
so it
the
makes
thing.
More of a solid?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So if you drop it in, you can make little balls. If you squirt it in, you make a little string.
So it's just
stuff.
You have something, and it's in one liquid. Do you...
Yeah,
put it in another. So you have the powder,
another, and it precipitates out.
Okay, so you have one liquid and another liquid, and you squirt it together, and it makes a solid.
Right, exactly. Okay. And it makes it solid in the shape of the first liquid, actually.
Okay, so it's for experiment for science class.
Right, but then there's an interesting twist that Julie has that we're going to try, and that is she puts a chelating agent in there, and it's specifically EDTA, which most of you have probably seen in consumer products. You've seen it in everything from consumer products to food.
Yeah, what is EDTA?
Ethylene diamine tetraacetic acid. And
it sounds scary, but it's a common thing.
Yeah, it's approved by the FDA. It's approved by the FDA to be used as sort of a metal scavenger. That's really what it is. So it's a chelating agent, and chelation is any compound that will coordinate at two or more sites with a metal. So whenever it coordinates at more than one site, it really sort of grabs onto it very tightly, and it keeps the metal from doing whatever it is the metal might otherwise do. And for example,
so does it bond with it?
Well, it does bond with it, okay. Right? But, I mean, Linus Pauling, who, by the way, is a two-time Nobel laureate, because that's the theme of today's show, would remind us that bond's a tricky word, right? It means a lot of different
things. It's
not
specific enough.
Right. It could be a covalent bond,
ionic
bond.
I'm not being pedantic enough.
Right. So but the particular bond that it does is relatively weak. But if it does it in two or more sites, like EDTA does, EDTA does it in six different sites for a typical positive metal ion.
So is this used for gluing things, metals together?
No, it's actually used for getting metals out of whatever it is you don't want the metal in.
Okay.
So, for example, people tend to use it to eliminate calcium. That ion can either form a salt or an oxide, and that forms scale, and that clogs up pipes.
Yeah.
Right? So EDTA can be used for
that. It's like a drain cleaner.
Yeah. In fact, it's used mainly in your food because sometimes you process food with metals. You grind things up, and you can't help but get a few metal ions in there. And the metal ions change the balance of how things go together.
So they put the EDTA in your food, or they use it to post-process the food?
They put it in your food to scavenge any metals that are in the system.
You're actually still swallowing it?
Yeah, you are, and it's actually approved by the FDA to go into.
So, if it's scavenging the metals, why would it? Like, why do they try to take the metals out of the food if you're still just eating the metals?
Well, actually, metals will do different things. If metals form salts or oxides, it will change the properties of whatever it is you've got.
So it's attracting the metals in the food to make some
kind of traps them.
Benign substance instead of letting them form salts.
It's a chelate. Okay, it's literally what it makes.
So if you have a piece of the tin in your tuna or something,
right? Exactly.
Okay. Right, well, it'll make it so it doesn't hurt
small
you.
Amounts of ions are not bad for you, right? I mean, and particularly if these are calcium, magnesium, iron ions, you need those to live. These are good things, right?
Do they put this in like canned sodas?
I don't know if they put it in canned sodas. So you have to look and see what it is. Okay. Anytime anyone is concerned about the property of their food or product as a function of the metal ions lying around, they put it in there.
Does it taste bad?
I don't know. I've never actually tasted it. Okay. Will you let me get to the point?
I'll let you get to the point.
All right. The point was, I was looking this up of like, where can I buy EDTA? So you can buy it from, you know, Fisher Scientific and VWR and all these catalog places. But I found that they sell it in health food stores as chelation therapy. And this frightened me. So let me be as unspecific as I possibly can. Is EDTA bad for you? Well, the FDA says it's not. But in large amounts, the problem is it's very unspecific. So what it does is, and by the way, it is approved by the FDA to be delivered intravenously to remove heavy metals like lead, right?
Yeah.
So there are plenty of studies.
So if you have lead poisoning, it probably would help with that.
Yeah, exactly. So if you have heavy metal poisoning like lead in particular, they put that in and they do it over several weeks. You probably get about three treatments a week. And they do it intravenously, and in your urine, they find all the lead sort of comes out.
Right.
So that's good. So they get rid of the accumulated lead in your body. That's a good thing. But the problem is it's very nonspecific. It loves calcium. It also doesn't like magnesium particularly well, but it also likes iron and other metals. So if you are just willy-nilly taking these pills, you are sucking
give you weak bones.
Yeah, right, exactly. And in fact, when they treat you for heavy metal poisoning, a lot of physicians will then give you calcium supplements during or after that to deal with the fact that it's taking all the good metals out of you as well. Mm-hmm. You want to get the lead out. And they've actually used different chelating therapies now since EDTA because EDTA is so good at grabbing all these metals. So it's a very rough kind of thing. It is not. Studies have indicated that the FDA has referenced that it does not get absorbed through the gastrointestinal tract that way. So actually taking pills, not necessarily that good. And then the problem is... It might do nothing. In fact, it's less effective. and I don't think we really know what it might do on the other side of your gastrointestinal tract. So people that make these claims, and the FDA has written letters to people that have made some of these claims. I actually read some online this week that say, oh, it's the miracle worker. It'll pull all the metal toxins out of your body. Well, that's true, but it'll pull a lot of the good metals out as well. So be very, very careful. And in fact, most people recommend you do not take more than 3 grams of EDTA in a particular day. And I'm not sure how much EDTA we're getting when we eat food. It's not a lot. They put in very small amounts of this stuff.
But since it's, since you said it doesn't go gastrointestinally very well.
Yeah, so it may not
be all
that effective.
If you eat it in the food, right. It might have made the metals benign, but then it'll just dissolve.
Right, won't do much.
Yeah.
Right. But anytime I see supplement folks saying, oh, here's a miracle drug, go ahead and take this stuff, it's really good.
Well, it's just marketing.
It frightens me, right? Physicians administer it all the time, and they do it intravenously because it's much more effective. If you start taking fistfuls of EDTA, I don't know what's going to happen. I just think that's kind of a scary thing. And unfortunately, there is not a lot of research on that, other than the fact that it's not very effective when it goes in there. But think about it. It chelates metals on the other side of the absorption in your GI tract. And I'm not sure exactly what that does. I could not find a study that actually suggested that. But all I'm saying is when you see this as a supplement, and the largest dosage I found was 850 milligrams per pill. And if you don't want to exceed that 3 grams per day rule, you just want to be careful. That's all I'm saying. So anyone that's on chelation therapy, it's a good thing for heavy metal poisoning. It's kind of a miracle drug in a sense because it keeps people from getting toxicity to that and dying. However, generally doing it, here's what I'm going to say. I'm going to pass the buck. Do not do chelation therapy unless it is under the supervision of a professional, and particularly a physician, or at the very least a dietitian, right? Because they'll understand that this can be a very rigorous method for pulling all the ions out of your system, and I'm not sure it's all that well understood. So there it is, chelation therapy. And again, just as an interesting side note, go ahead and look at some consumer products. You will find this EDTA all over the place when you actually look at them. All right, so on to Nobel Prizes. So should we start with physics first?
Sure.
All right, I'm going to start with physics first. Let me get my notes here. I got a lot of notes here. And this much I will say, that I will probably butcher the fundamentals of the way the details of the Nobel Prize in physics. However, the good news is next week, Ken Brown from the School of Chemistry and Biochemistry, who does research in these trapped ions and studying their quantum states and using them for what we think is the really cool application of this quantum computer, will be here next week. So he will straighten out any problems that I may have had. So the 2012 Nobel Prize in Physics was given to Sergei Haroche, who at the time, well, I guess this is his current affiliation, is the École Normale Supérieure Paris-France. And basically that's sort of like the College of France is basically what that translates to. And David J. Wineland, who's affiliated with the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, or as his geeks like to call it, NIST, in Boulder, Colorado, and the University of Colorado, Boulder. And the prize motivation was for groundbreaking experimental methods for enabling that enable measuring and manipulation of individual quantum systems.
That would make the quantum computing easier, correct?
Well,
if they're making measurements of quantum systems easier.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that you can look at individual quantum states, right?
So, the state or the superposition or.
Well, yeah. So that's the whole issue, is the superposition,
yes.
Right? That really what's relevant to us is when we measure it.
Well, it's not necessarily the issue. It's what gives quantum computers usefulness.
Right. And I guess to some degree, it's just density. It's density of memory and speed, right? So if you think about it, we're always trying to make denser memory.
Mm-hmm.
And the limit we have, as Cliff Henderson pointed out a couple weeks ago, is the size that we can make a transistor, right? So digital computing is all about making a switch, right? That's an oversimplification, but that's really it. You want to switch things on and off, make them a zero or a one.
You should come back to, computers that aren't quantum computers, just your everyday standard computer, mm-hmm. Works, it turns everything into bits. So it's that's where you get the zeros and the ones. So
right.
Electricity is either on or electricity is off, which is why you have all these switches turning things on and off.
Right. And in computers, the it's either the bias is, up
in computers,
or down, on or off.
You
right.
take the information and you convert the information into bits. So, you have a number, you have, a Wikipedia document, you have whatever. That gets turned into zeros and ones down the computer level. And they can only store zeros and ones. But quantum computers, since they're dealing in the quantum space, And they can be a zero, a one, or a combination of the two.
Right.
So it gives you a little extra information in the pieces you're looking at, which is why it's not the same as having a transistor. Because a transistor could only be on and off, but the quantum state can be, you know, some combination of those two.
Right, which is why the combination of the two, you're talking about the superposition principle.
Yeah, so it can be zero, one combination. So you get more information in each thing you're storing.
Right. Plus, each thing that you're storing, it isn't a transistor. That as much as
right.
you know, Cliff talked about it being smaller and smaller and smaller, it is a finite thing. It has many, many atoms in this construct. Whereas these things are typically a single ion, right?
So well, it's basically like they take the things that are very, very small, and they're just looking for things that they can, like that, you know, have a duality that can be on or off. So right. maybe they take, okay, this spins this way or this spins this way. Okay, we're going to use those two things to say on or off instead of like right. whether it has electricity through it or not.
Right. And so typically we use an energetic state in an ion.
Right.
What this is eventually going to be.
Yeah.
So, but the fact that it's an ion and not maybe thousands or tens of thousands or millions right. of atoms in a transistor, and we're getting them down to the point where it's a smaller and smaller
cluster. But I'm just saying a quantum computer is not useful, or not only useful because you can make it smaller. It's because you're basing it on a different thing of it can be a little more non-deterministic, which is useful sometimes.
So when you say non-deterministic, it's
like,
good for stochastic computing.
And stuff like that. Or because if you're talking about, I don't know, I don't want to get too detailed in state machines or anything.
Somewhere somebody's going to have to explain the Schrödinger cat.
Yeah, I don't want to explain
we
all
wanna
that.
We want to avoid that.
Yeah, but I'm just saying it allows you to compute. So some things that would take a long time on a normal computer would go faster on a quantum computer because like the algorithm would be different because they can take advantage of some of those non-deterministic properties. So it's not like you're just taking a normal computer and making it smaller, mm-hmm. and that's why quantum computers. So it's not. We're not trying to make quantum computers just because, oh, I can have, you know, the equivalent of billions of transistors in this small little right. space and it's going to be faster. It's also you can just fundamentally compute things, like, differently.
Right. And think about it. A lot of interesting simulations. Simulations that I do, simulations that the weather guys do, are what's called stochastic, right? That means they have a statistical element to them. They are not completely deterministic.
Yeah.
Which, in fact, the world, because of quantum mechanics and the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, is not completely deterministic as well, right? So a lot of times what we'll do is we'll have, you know, atoms or something moving around, and then we realize that at any particular point where we're going to move it in a certain way, there's a probability that goes this way or that way. And what we have to do with a digital computer is actually spend a lot of cycles computing random numbers that are never really random, by the way, right? You computing guys like to call them pseudo-random numbers.
You can get random numbers.
They're pretty close.
Well, you have to, you know, connect an external thing and get them from that. But.
Right, but the point is what you're saying is you have a little bit of this stochastic element built right in the nature that can be.
Kind of, yeah. So a place where you'd have to be on a normal computer, we'd say, okay, try this, now try this. And a quantum computer, it could just do both.
Right. Wow, beautiful.
But yeah, before we get too deep into quantum computers, what was the Nobel Prize for? Because we'll talk about the quantum stuff next week.
But the Nobel Prize was actually for their ability to access these individual quantum states.
Okay.
And let's face it, we've known about quantum states.
So when do they do this work?
Oh, this is... So like with most...
it's pretty old. It's like not that old, but it's pretty old.
This has been done over a long, long time. So for example, the work that Ken Brown's currently engaged in builds on this sort of stuff. And that really is the application, right? The possible application of these ion traps. And basically what it is... You trap an ion in two different ways.
Was this from the 90s or the 80s?
All right, I don't have any dates in here. I'm actually looking at the Nobel Prize website's description of it.
Okay. Well,
and this was over a long, long time period.
Yeah. They rarely give, I guess, Nobel Prizes for some specific thing anymore in science or physics. It's usually like someone was working on something for a long time.
Well, because it's difficult to do.
Yeah,
right?
It's difficult to have like a eureka moment that changes everything.
Right.
It happens sometimes,
Every single one of these three Nobel Prizes were that way. Can you remember the last time we really had something that was a eureka moment?
I don't know.
Let's look at general relativity. That was not a eureka moment. That was Einstein working for a decade or more on tensor calculus.
Well, I mean, just on the outside, it'll look like a eureka moment, but that scientist is the problem they've been working on for 20 years.
Yeah. Yeah, so basically, we had two different approaches to this sorts of things. All right, let me see. The David Wineland would trap these ions inside electric fields. So this was a high vacuum system where he trapped these things inside of electric fields and get them to a very, very low energy state. I mean, that really means pulling out as much of the thermal energy, the kinetic energy, as you can. Mm-hmm. And if you have an isolated molecule, you can actually do that. And believe it or not, if they're moving around too much, you can actually stop them not only with the electric field, but by hitting them with ions,
mm-hmm.
sort of the light pressure of ions. We call them light tweezers. We can actually move individual atoms around and things like that. Get them to this low energy state called a superposition state. And from that, he could actually sample and control these quantum states. Not only does this potentially have use in quantum computing, but extremely accurate clocks, much more accurate than the cesium clock now.
Mm-hmm.
And these are ions, right? So the quantum state that we're actually looking at here is a quantum state that everyone has sampled, but not sampled for an individual ion, for lots and lots of ions. Anytime you've ever taken, as a common experiment done in analytical chemistry, a metal salt, and you put the metal salt in a flame, mm-hmm. and you realize that depending on what the metal was, the color was different. So that UV visible energy transition is the heat from the flame would actually heat this thing up. And then when it jumped down from a highly excited quantum state back down to a lower state, it would release a photon. And it was a photon of a particular wavelength because that energy change was quantized. So we've been looking at quantum states for a long, long time. But the ability to isolate one individual one is really what all this work is about. It was the end of the 19th century when we were actually looking at those sorts of things and understanding what they were. Now, Sergei Hirosh does a slightly different version. He actually takes, I think it's a microwave phonon, and puts it between superconducting mirrors. And the mirrors are so reflective that this thing can actually bounce back and forth for a tenth of a second before it's lost or absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if you think about how fast light goes, that's hitting it a lot of times. It will have traveled over 40,000 kilometers, which is about a trip around the Earth, before it's actually absorbed. And then he mixes these with something called a Rydberg atom. And a Rydberg atom is an atom where the electrons, the outer shell electrons, sometimes called the valence electron, is actually pumped up to one of those high energy states.
Mm-hmm.
And these have very interesting properties that make the work plausible. They're really big. They're fat. Because if you think about it, if you take it to a higher energy state, it's sort of swollen in its orbit.
Mm-hmm.
To use Niels Bohr's classical view of it, even though it's a quantum phenomenon. And it's a different approach, but basically we are on the verge of a new computer revolution because of this sort of thing. So so there it is, quantum computing. And we've muddled up that pretty good, but what we'll do is we'll get Professor Brown here, Ken Brown, next week to talk about how it's actually applied. And what's weird about this superposition thing is that you're in a state that in theory is both, right? The excited or the low energy state.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say this, it's always bothered me that they have used Schrödinger's cat, right? Schrödinger's equation,
yeah.
Right? One of the fathers of modern quantum mechanics. But it's interesting, in reading on this, I actually found out that you know, what they do is they use the quantum state of a molecule to determine whether or not a poison is released inside a box with a cat. So in theory, what it means is you don't know if the cat's dead or alive until you actually sample it. It's one of the paradoxes of quantum mechanics. It's always been absurd because to couple a single state to something macroscopic just seems strange to me. And in fact, according to the Nobel Prize website, in Schrödinger's view, this thought experiment led to an absurd conclusion, and it is said that he later tried to apologize for adding to the quantum confusion with this thing. So,
it's a metaphor at a larger scale, and it doesn't make sense because, it obviously doesn't make sense.
Right, but I find it confusing. And it's philosophy people that always say, well, don't you understand Schrödinger's cat? I never understood Schrödinger's cat.
They just like the philosophical aspect of it, like...
Right,
and that doesn't happen. The cat. The cat's not going to happen, though.
But there it is. The 2012 Nobel Prize awarded for work that help us access individual quantum states that have the potential for rapidly increasing the efficiency and effectiveness of computing. Not only because of the size scale, but also because of this stochastic superposition principle, which Ken's going to explain to us better. And it also has the possibility of making extremely accurate clocks, much more accurate than the atomic cesium clock now that's typically used. So let's take a break, and we come back. Let's talk about the Chemistry Nobel Prize. And if you've got a question or comment, or you can add, hopefully not to the conclusion, but to the lucidity of the description for the one in physics or the ones in physiology or medicine and chemistry, give us a call here at the studio if you're listening live Wednesdays noon to 1 at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.
If you like big band jazz, you'll love the DeSoto Hour. Airing Saturdays from 6 to 8 p.m., we'll play old school big band standards from the good old days and much more. So set your radio dial to 91.1 FM WREK Atlanta. Saturdays from 6 to 8 for the DeSoto Hour.
This is Friction. Friction Wednesdays, 10 p.m. on WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're reviewing the 2012 Nobel Prizes in Physics, Chemistry, and Medicine or Physiology. And now on to chemistry. All right, let me get my notes here. I got a lot of notes here. So let me actually recommend, if you're interested in these particular areas, probably some of the best information, and they actually boil it down so normal people can, and that would include me, because these are not my areas of expertise, can actually understand these sorts of things. So the Chemistry Prize went to Robert J. Lefkowitz and Brian K. Kobilka. Robert J. Lefkowitz is actually associated with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. I'm guessing that means he's a Howard Hughes Medical Institute investigator. They give out a lot of money for some very interesting medical research. He's associated with the Duke University Medical Center in Durham, North Carolina. And then Brian K. Kobilka is affiliated with the Stanford University School of Medicine. So interestingly enough, it's given in chemistry, but you've got people associated with two medical centers. Kind of highlights the multidisciplinary collaborative nature of research today. That may not have been the case 20, 30, 40 years ago, but
well,
nowadays
the Nobel Prizes tend to like err on the side of being something practical a little bit too.
They're supposed to.
Yeah,
actually,
Alfred Nobel's will, they're supposed
to have a real practical, I'm paraphrasing, that's not exactly how he said it. But very often I think they don't necessarily have a practical implication.
Well, that's why it's the medical professionals get it for chemistry.
Right. So to be honest, it's what is it? This really is chemistry, but it just happens to be biochemistry. So
right.
The folks that are working on this, and I have no idea whether their background is in medicine, chemistry, biochemistry, and it doesn't really matter. Ironically, Steve Harvey, who co-hosts the program from time to time, works on the structure of RNA and DNA and how they're folded into little capsids, the way viruses work. But his original degree is in physics.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'm actually looking at a summary of the Nobel laureates in chemistry, and they have highlighted on the Nobel website those that have received multiple Nobel Prizes who also won it in chemistry. And Frederick Sanger is the only one that won it twice in chemistry. Marie Curie won it in chemistry and physics. And Linus Pauling, of all things, won it in chemistry and peace. And I will remind you, his initial studies were in chemical engineering. Booyah. So, in fact, at the graduate level, chemistry, chemical engineering, material science, biochemistry, microbiology, they overlap significantly. But these were awarded for studies in G-protein-coupled receptors. All right, let me see if I can get a coherent summary of this. And this actually comes from the description of how it works. And there's they usually on the website give you the technical one. They have one for physics. And then they give you the one for just regular people. Believe it or not, for medicine, they only give you one, and it's sort of the advanced technical one. But this is the description for us normal folks who don't know everything there is to know about G-protein-coupled receptors. It says, sensors on the cell surface called receptors. Robert J. Lefkowitz and Brian Kobilka are awarded the 2012 Nobel Prize for having mapped how a family of receptors called G-protein-coupled receptors work. In this family, we find receptors for adrenaline, dopamine, serotonin, light, flavor, and odor. How interesting. Most physiological processes depend on GPCRs, which is what they're called. That's, I believe it's guanidine regulatory binding protein coupled receptors, right? About half of all medications act through these receptors, among them beta blockers, antihistamines, and various kinds of psychiatric medications. And obviously, the psychiatric medications deal with neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin. And in fact, Dr. Miller, who was on the program last week, we're talking about antidepressives and how different things like cancer therapies can actually interfere with those uptake mechanisms. And I've actually done a little bit of work on this a long, long time ago with a graduate student. And in fact, people would say that G-protein coupled receptors, and this was years ago, are the single most important signal transduction mechanism in all of biology. So it's not just how drugs work, it's how cells talk to other cells. We had Professor Hammer on here about a month or two ago talking about quorum sensing in bacteria. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that is an example of how bacteria talk to each other. But how our cells learn about their environment and what they're supposed to do is via this mechanism. And they basically talk about that by the end of the 19th century, they were experimenting with all these things that bind to receptors and trigger responses. But it's literally over the last 100 years that they've actually figured this out. And it's over the last several decades. It's starting in the 1980s where a lot of this work was done. They understood that, and there are lots of different kinds of receptors. This particular receptor, and I find it always better to I could put a face on it, I guess, right? Because we think about a receptor as some weird enigma. Mm-hmm. In fact, they use the word enigma here, that the receptor was an elusive enigma. It's really a molecule situated in a certain way. And for lack of a more precise description, I'm going to leave it with that. In particular, G-protein coupled receptors typically have 7, although others might say it just has to be odd. It doesn't have to be 7. It has to be an odd number of helices, right? So helices we can understand. We can understand the helical staircase. We know about the twisted helix in DNA. Linus Pauling, who I just mentioned a while ago, won the Nobel Prize for discovering the structure of the alpha helix in a protein, right? So this is sort of twisted hydrogen bonds along that sort of keep it as a rod. And you have typically 7, but it always has to be an odd number, residing in the membrane of a cell. Mm-hmm. So these are membrane receptors, right? Namely that they must be made of some amino acids that don't mind sitting in the slightly greasy, non-hydrophilic nature of the membrane, right? So they sit in there, and basically the protein forms a helix, and one helix goes out and in and out and in and out and in and out and in. One end of it is sitting outside the receptor. One end of it is sitting inside the receptor. Inside the cell and outside the cell. And what happens is whatever it is, whatever ligand, right, that's the name of the molecule that triggers something, comes in and is going to tell your cell to do something. It binds on the outside end of those 7 helices, literally floating around, right? And in fact, flexibility is specifically mentioned in this description of that. And they're kind of floating around in the membrane. But when something binds to it, and we still argue about how exactly it binds to it. because it tends to bind to, sometimes it gets in the middle of the helices, but the loops, right, in between the helices have something to do with it. Because believe it or not, for the human thrombin receptor, which is related to some work we did, if you change the loops, you change the way it works. So they're not just dangling there, connecting these helices floating around. Think of cylindrical buoys floating in the water. That's really what they're like. If you change those, it changes the behavior of the receptor. So a lot of people think that the loops sort of grab hold of the molecule, pull it down in there, it binds. When it binds, it changes the spatial arrangement of these helices. Now, on the inside, it is connected to this G protein. It has an alpha and a beta part, and that change in conformation tells the protein to go do something interesting. And this is something I don't fully understand. But because it is a nucleotide binding protein, what it basically does is deals with the DNA-RNA transcription process. So, in fact, it can either interfere and downregulate something or bind and upregulate something. So it basically is affecting your genes, right? So this is a way that a molecule absorbed into the sort of receptor at the outer edge of the cell tells the machinery of your nucleus to make or not make or do something different based on your genetic code. And if you think about it, that is why it's the single most important signal transduction mechanism in all of biology. And that, so basically finding a drug that will either bind and make it do something or bind and interfere with the conformational change, right? So if it binds, it's an agonist. It's behaving like something we normally might see in our physiological environment that would cause it to do something. Or if whatever that thing is, say a histamine molecule, you know, so we hear things like antihistamine and beta blockers. These tend to be antagonists where they will go in and they can bind, but they don't induce the conformational change, right? So they don't tell the G protein on the inside to do what it's going to do to change your genetic machinery to get it to do whatever it is. And in this case, maybe, you know, produce mucus and things like that in the case of antihistamine. And those things would be antagonists. But it's this mechanism that allowed us to design drugs and understand how to do this sort of thing. And, you know, I'm not familiar necessarily with the odor one, but I do know this, that many of your taste buds use G-protein-coupled receptors. So that's what they mean by flavor. There was an example we would always quote when we talked about how important these things are. We actually used Meganin peptides, which is a similar class where the helices are completely separate, as sort of a metaphor to understand how these things actually work, and went on to find out that they actually have impact in transdermal drug delivery. And many of you may have heard Professor Mark Prosnitz talk to us about a month ago about transdermal drug delivery. And I think he mentioned briefly at the end how Meganins are actually an agent to increase transdermal drug delivery. So I guess, Trent, this is really an example of, it's an entire class of receptors that now people have gone off and studied, you know, how to make drugs, to interfere with these things, to activate these things, how to mediate these things, how they fundamentally work. So they really started it all.
Okay.
So much of modern drug therapy.
So they found the original receptors.
Yeah, they came up with the mechanism, right? Okay. So until we drew the, and there's a nice picture of these seven helices sitting there in the membrane. And here they actually have an example of inactive and active, and they actually show a conformational change. These things shift, they move, they change the packing of the helices, and then that conformational change induces a change on the G protein, which in fact does what it does. So in a sense, before this, and they understand it so well that we now know the amino acids in these things.
Mm-hmm.
So we can actually take them, we can build them in the helices, we can model them in a computer, we can actually look and see how they behave. And if you think about it, you look and see what atoms are on the outside, you could at least make some reasonable predictions as to as to what might bind with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sufficiently short, you can actually make the helices. You can physically use Merrifield solid state synthesis, where you have a bead and you grow the peptide from it, and actually get some understanding about how these things actually work. Getting them folded is a little bit tougher, but the fact that we have a picture is what gives us better predictive capability about how this thing works. And we no longer have to do sort of trial and error, which is how a lot of drug research was done you know, at the beginning of the 20th century that they referred to for figuring out what does what. So there it is. I guess it is the fundamental basis of modern drug discovery, the G-protein coupled receptors. So, okay, let's take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the Nobel Prize in Medicine or Physiology, and then we'll try to conclude with the amazing things that the work awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics, Chemistry, and Medicine, I guess, have imparted to us as a world. We'll be right back with the 2012 edition of Nobel Pursuits on Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.
It's not hard to find the best reggae that Atlanta has to offer. Know your roots. Keep it simple. Tune in to 5446, Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m., only on WREK Atlanta.
Whether it's rock, blues, electronic, hip-hop, R&B, or reggae, they all have one thing in common. You can hear them all during the Rock, Rhythm, and Wolves sound block, Monday through Thursday from 1 to 6 p.m. and 1 to 5 p.m. on Fridays, only at WREK Atlanta 91.1 FM.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box. And today we're talking about the 2012 Nobel Prizes in Physics, Chemistry, and Medicine or Physiology. And we've reached the Medicine or Physiology one. It's awarded to Sir John B. Gordon and Shinya Yamanaka. Sir John B. Gordon was actually from the United Kingdom and is currently associated with the Gordon Institute in Cambridge in the United Kingdom. Of course, he has his own institute because this is the guy that basically figured out how to clone things, right? His technique, which we'll talk about in a second, was used to clone Dolly, the first mammal, the first sheep ever cloned. And it is shared by Shinya Yamanaka, who is associated with Kyoto University in Kyoto, Japan, and the Gladstone Institutes in San Francisco, California, in the United States. And it is for the discovery that mature cells can be reprogrammed to become pluripotent. And pluripotency is something we talked about back in February 2010 when Todd McDevitt from the Georgia Institute of Technology was on here talking about his research in stem cells. And he pointed out that, you know, even if you take a stem cell, you can't just do what's depicted in what's my favorite late night cartoon? Futurama. Do you watch Futurama?
Is it still on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They occasionally make a new show.
Okay.
I figure you watch every weird, bad, poor taste cartoon on late night because you tell me about them. So
yeah, I'm okay with that.
So in any case, yeah, I think there was an episode where the professor just slapped, glommed on a bunch of stem cells and suddenly made him young and good looking again.
Yes.
And Todd pointed out it doesn't actually do that. But what's interesting is not only does this have tremendous application for, I don't want to say cloning because cloning scares people, but let's say tissue engineering, regenerative repair of organs and tissue and things like that. but it represents a fundamental shift. So the description on the Nobel Prize website points out that the prevalent view during the first half of the 20th century was that mature cells, that means, you know, you have a skin cell, a heart cell, a cell on the lining of your arteries and things like that, were permanently locked in their differentiated state, that they have changed or differentiated to the point where they were a liver cell, right, a hepatocyte or something like that, and they are unable to return to a fully immature pluripotent stem cell state. That's that pluripotent, the ability to differentiate into other things. And in 1962, and this is a really good example because John Gurdon actually did this in the early 60s, and it was only recently in the last 5 to 10 years that Shinji Yamanaka actually did his work. But there's sort of the beginning and ending of a series of work that had us disprove this prevalent view for the first half of the 20th century. And in 1962, John Gurdon radically changed this view by demonstrating that a nucleus from a differentiated frog intestinal epithelial cell was capable of generating a fully functional tadpole upon transplantation to an enucleated egg. So you take an egg, an ovum, you pull out the nucleus, and then you transplant a nucleus from a fully differentiated cell, and it is that stem cell nature, that non-somatic nature, somatic cell.
So they're able to take, it was like a liver cell or something, and they were able to take that and turn it into another type of cell?
Well, so in this case, they actually grew a complete tadpole.
Okay.
So you basically can take a...
So what do they grow the tadpole out of?
Out of an enucleated egg, right? Okay. And I don't remember whether this one was actually a frog egg or not, but it didn't necessarily have to be. That's the whole thing. And in fact, let's see, his discovery introduced a new research field that centered on somatic cell nuclear transfer, SCNT, right? So you take a somatic cell, which is one of these already mature differentiated type cells, and take its nucleus and reprogram it into an ovum or stem cell. And this somatic cell nuclear transfer method eventually led in 1997 to the first cloned mammal, the sheep Dolly, who was born after an SCNT from an adult mammary epithelial cell into a enucleated, so they're able to
take cells and then turn them into like their stem cells,
right?
But
right.
It still keeps some stuff, which is why they were able to clone the sheep and it was the same because they took the cells, mm-hmm. made the cells kind of restart, but they still remember the information. So when it grew up, then it was the same sheep,
right?
So it kept the DNA, but the cells were able to grow and start again.
Right. And then what Yamanaka did is rather than taking what was available at the time, and in 1962, I'm just amazed this happened in 1962.
Yeah.
You know, rather than just literally going in there and brute force, pull a nucleus out of one and put it in another, because that was the state of the art of microbiology, what Yamanaka proved was that the introduction of a small set of transcription factors into a differentiated cell was sufficient to revert the cell to the pluripotent state, that this is this stem cell type state where it can differentiate in other things. And basically what he was doing is, you know, sort of what we talked about with the G protein coupled receptor. Transcription factors are basically proteins that mess with the activity or lack of activity of your DNA and RNA, right? So they'll actually bind in there and upregulate or downregulate certain features. And he did this all initially with only 24 transcription factors. So what he can do is chemically fool the system into going backwards, right? So this idea was actually suggested by
John
Gordon.
But it's still keeping the DNA, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
But if you think about it, your differentiated cells and your non-differentiated cells, and no matter what they're differentiated into, have all the DNA.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the key is we always thought that a liver cell just grows into a liver cell, that there's no way to trick it.
Well, a liver cell stays a liver cell.
Right, exactly.
Not turns into something and grows, a heart.
Right, and basically what he did is not only could he get it to trick it to change something else, he actually got it. Tricked it to create a new mouse. So he could take a mature somatic type cell.
What's the somatic?
Somatic is one of these differentiated
So somatic is cells, right? Mature.
So get it to go backwards. And this sort of sealed the deal on this idea that you can actually get things to go backwards.
And to clone things.
What he did is he actually grew an entirely new mouse. So he had a differentiating mouse cell. So it
wasn't
just
if you need a new liver, they could grow you a new liver with your cells?
Okay, so let's talk about that now. That is the whole idea of stem cell research.
Right.
That if you can take stem cells, whether it's, what do we call it, a xenograft, right? It's from a different species, and there's different words. There's autograft, I think that's you. Allograft is same species, but a different organism, things like that. They got all sorts of Latin names for these sorts of things, and I mess them up all the time. But basically, if we could regrow healthy tissue by putting stem cells that had just the right environment, and that's the point that Todd McDevitt make. You can't just slap them in there.
Right.
To grow and recreate new tissue. More importantly, if you can monkey with the nucleus, right, which John Gurdon actually pointed out, you could actually put in growing stem cells, near liver tissue or endothelial tissue or lung tissue, whatever it is, that aren't, for example, missing a particular gene, right, that gives you a bad pathology, right? So not only can we clone things, right, and I think that scares a lot of folks so far. Basically, we've cloned mouse with Yamanaka's technique simply by doing it chemically, we can actually create new tissue. So what a lot of people think is the big application of this is what's called tissue engineering, even though Yamanaka and Gurdon actually made new growing organisms out of these kinds of things. But I think what's probably most interesting is we don't necessarily have to depend on pluripotent embryonic stem cells, for example,
mm-hmm.
right? We can now take these somatic cells and go backwards. So this probably has the interesting implications for what are called adult stem cells. And we produce stem cells as well, right? We grow stem cells in our bone marrow and things like that, or cells in general.
Mm-hmm.
So the ability of us to trick it to be a pluripotent stem cell has amazing ramifications. And to the credit of the Nobel Committee, this is a relatively recent discovery, right? Yamanaka's discovery. They give it not only for Yamanaka's discovery, which really is paving the way for tissue engineering that will not get the conservatives upset, right? You don't necessarily have to use embryonic stem cells to do this because you can go backwards. And they also gave it to the man who paved the way for this entire field. I thought it was an excellent choice for just that reason. So there it is. Tissue engineering. I know the tissue engineering folks here are very excited about this sort of stuff. And actually, we should get Todd McDevitt back on the program to talk about the details of this very thing. So there it is, ladies and gentlemen, the Nobel Prizes for 2012 in physics, chemistry, and medicine physiology, which have tremendous impacts in sort of the new wave of computing that will be much more efficient, much more effective than the current digital ways that we do it. It's a long way off. How far off? We'll have Ken Brown on the program next week to talk about that. In chemistry, it is the basis for much of the physiological treatment of diseases and drug discovery, the G protein-coupled receptor, the single most important cell transduction mechanism in all of biology. And then finally, an understanding of the ability to reverse somatic cells back to their pluripotent or stem cell-like state in medicine and physiology, thereby giving us the ability to engineer all sorts of tissues and organs and things like that. Absolutely should be amazing. What the ramifications for actually cloning people or other animals are, I'm not going to deal with that. The future looks bright. Yeah, these were really good choices that are going to have tremendous positive impact, I think, on society. Did I leave anything out?
I don't think so.
Okay. All right. Well, there it is, the 2012 Nobel Prizes. Thank you so much for joining us here on Inside the Black Box. If you've got a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future program here, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Our chief engineer is Trent Altman, who's back from what, partying in New York?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. Was there some partying in New York?
Probably.
Okay. And we did start a little bit late, but Trent was actually working on a personal matter, helping out a dear friend.
Yeah,
you say it like that, no one's going to give you crap.
Yeah, no one's going to give me crap.
And that's actually true. No one would have thought you have dear friends or that you actually help them, but in fact, he was doing that very thing. Our theme music is composed and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt, and we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.